Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. The digital revolution, the computer revolution, new technologies, all of these are often considered to be sympathetic to a green environment, as they don't require paper and they seem to get away from the old smokestack industries of yesterday. Our guest today, Richard Maxwell, co-author of a new book, Greening the Media, will tell us why that's wrong and what we ought to understand about the effects on the environment of our new communication technologies. It's going to be a wonderful hour. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Dozens of foreign countries and aid organizations have pledged to give Afghanistan $16 billion in help over the next 4 years. This is intended to help stem violence and assist Afghans in improving their economic circumstances. But many donors are worried about the Afghan government's record of corruption, so some of the aid will also depend on whether Afghans meet certain requirements on ending corruption and adopting more good government measures. Still, the pledge money is not as much as Afghanistan had sought. Meanwhile, dozens of people died in Afghanistan because of a spike in insurgent activity this weekend. NPR's Sean Carberry reports that civilians, Afghan police, and NATO troops have been killed in separate attacks and explosions.
Insurgents attacked a police checkpoint in Helmand Province early Sunday, wounding 3 officers. At least 20 insurgents were killed in the 4-hour firefight. 5 police officers died when their vehicle struck a roadside bomb on the way to the battle. In Kandahar Province, more than 12 civilians died in 3 separate roadside bombing incidents. 2 NATO troops also died in different incidents in southern Afghanistan. Despite security gains in the last couple of years, insurgent activity remains high in Kandahar and Helmand provinces. And Saturday, a woman was killed by a blast in Farah Province, where insurgents launched an unsuccessful rocket attack on the house of the governor. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
With the U.S. presidential election just months away, the NAACP says it's running its biggest get-out-the-vote campaign ever. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports the civil rights group says it is an effort to counter the passage of voting laws that it considers restrictive.
The NAACP is running a voter registration call center at its convention this week in Houston. That's the latest step in the civil rights group's effort to get thousands to the polls come November. Marvin Randolph says although the NAACP has conducted voter registration drives before, this one is quite different.
It is our hope that through the people that we already have on the rolls and the people that we are bringing on the rolls, that we will have a universe of close to 1 million voters that we will be activating this election cycle.
Randolph says the NAACP's Get Out the Vote campaign is in sharp contrast to laws passed in at least 10 states requiring people to show a government-issued photo ID to vote. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Houston.
Effective at midnight, the FBI will stop running servers that held back a malicious software program. Now, this means some people who may be infected by the computer virus could have trouble getting online. Experts say that computer users should visit this website for help, dcwg.org. Again, that's dcwg.org. The winner of this year's men's title at the Wimbledon Tennis Championship is Roger Federer. He defeated home favorite and Briton, Andy Murray. This is NPR News. Pet owners around the country are struggling to protect their animals in this heat wave. It's harder for animal shelters, which tend to hundreds of animals, as they cope with the heat and humidity. From CMU Public Radio in Michigan, Jessica Schott reports.
With heat advisories being declared across the nation and temperatures in many states hitting triple digits, keeping cool has become a top priority. Chelsea Tenwaldy is kennel supervisor for Isabella County Animal Control in Michigan. She says shelters work hard to keep their animals comfortable despite the oppressive heat.
We always make sure all the dogs in the shelter, dogs and cats for that matter, have fresh water You know, we have fans on all the time, and recently we've had air conditioning installed in the kennels. We're going to make sure they stay as cool as possible.
Tenwaldy encourages pet owners to provide their animals with fresh water, cool shelter, or shade if the animals must remain outdoors. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Schott in Mount Pleasant, Michigan.
Peace envoy Kofi Annan is now in Syria's capital. A spokesman for Annan says he's there for talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Annan, a former UN Secretary General, is working on behalf of the UN and the Arab League to stop warfare in Syria. But just yesterday, he told a French newspaper he believes peace efforts in Syria have failed. A former prime minister of Libya who rebelled against Muammar Gaddafi is claiming he and his party are winning the country's parliamentary elections. Faisal Krikshi says he learned the news from members of his political party who were at ballot counting centers. But Libyan election officials will not confirm his claim. Libya staged its first free national election yesterday since Gaddafi's ouster. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 8th, 2012, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the co-author of a new book, Greening the Media, just published by Oxford University Press. Richard Maxwell is a professor of communication at Queens College in New York City. His co-author, Toby Miller, was going to be on the air with us. He's in Mexico, and we were having phone difficulties. Toby's listening in online. May send some comments if he can via email that will interject when possible, if he's able to do so. But we're fortunate enough to have Rick Maxwell with us. Rick, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing real well, thanks. And you know, I'm a big fan of your book, having read it early on, and think it's really cutting into areas that have been largely neglected, not entirely, but largely neglected by not only most scholars and journalists, but people in general, not really aware of the environmental implications, ecological implications of new communication technologies. And, you know, it seems, Rick, you have a great quote in there by Esther Dyson from 1994. She was one of the gurus of the internet revolution, the information age. And Esther Dyson said something to the effect that we're now in an era in which the mind is much more important than material issues, that this is a new post-material world. And in that environment, then, in that culture, I guess, environmental concerns no longer play a role, since that's the truly material world. And, you know, what's wrong with Esther Dyson? Where did she miss the boat?
Well, that's another book in itself, Bob. But the reason why we set that as a kind of foil for one of the discussions we have is that a lot of the smart people who are talking about new technologies as future-oriented, as high-tech, as the design smart economy and all of this stuff miss the boat on the actual physical materiality of where these things come from. And let me just say, first of all, you know, Toby and I weren't the first ones to get to this. We actually inherited a lot of good work already out there by people like Ted Smith at the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. And there are others, too. Chad Raphael, who you know has been working on some of these issues. We tapped into a counter-narrative of technology that had been active in a way for a long time, at least since the early 1980s, and probably before that when we were talking about Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and these kind of things. It just hadn't been connected to the area that you and I both work in, which is communications. And that was the goal of the book, was to sort of synthesize all of this and bring it together and say, hey, wait a minute, it's the hardware.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, this mythology of, I mean, so the average person, though, they say, gee whiz, I'm getting my books now on a Kindle, or I'm getting it on an iPad or a tablet computer. You know, so the books are no longer being printed, ink is no longer being used, factories are no longer producing all the sort of stuff that screws up the environment that's been so deleterious for the last century or two. This has to be a positive thing. How could this possibly not be a positive development for humanity's relationship with the natural environment?
Well, it's on the surface it looks that way for sure, but the books haven't gone away. We're printing more paper than ever. Paperless society never came into being. And, you know, these technologies have their own carbon footprint. They have their own emissions issues. They're just deceptive. You know, you hold an iPhone in your hand or an iPod in your hand, or you look at a wonderful sort of aluminum, brushed aluminum computer in front of you, and you think, damn, this is the post-industrial world, when in fact they come from the old-fashioned industrialism. There are factories everywhere. Pollution's on the rise, and a lot of this has to do with the consumption, the production and consumption of these modern technologies.
One of the things you do in the book, Rick Maxwell, that's really interesting is you link the environment very much to production practices, how, just like you were saying, to factories that build these things and create these things. And, you know, I think Americans have finally gotten a sense that iPhones don't just magically appear out of the sky when someone at Apple waves a magic wand. But they aren't made here. They aren't made in factories that Americans work in, that Americans drive by and see the smog and see the grunge. What is the nature of the production process for information technology today? How does it develop? I mean, what is the real world of this?
Right. Well, you know, there's a global supply chain that provides a lot of the technology, but it begins with the research and design in places like Palo Alto and places like Cupertino. And if you had to actually chart the value that's added to the information technology economy, it sort of looks like a big smile, where you have high-value goods at the design and research end of it, and then high-value goods at retailing and marketing end. And at the bottom, where the sort of smile dips way down, is where the manufacturing takes place, where the low-value products, as they say, where the low-wage workers work. And these tend to be in places like China, and this has become something of a headline issue now that we've seen how Apple workers in the Foxconn factories have been pressed and pushed toward suicide and protests and other kinds of complaints about the working conditions. And the consumers in this country can see why Apple's smiling, because a lot of this is due to the fact that they're exploiting major factories in places like China.
Our guest today, Rick Maxwell, the co-author with Toby Miller of the new book, Greening the Media, just published by Oxford University Press. This is a live show. We welcome your phone calls. The number here at WILL is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, for those of you outside the area, 1-800-222-9455. Rick Maxwell, when you teach like I do, you teach at Queens College in New York City, and you teach courses on media. And what is your sense of how students today that you're dealing with, their understanding of the environment, you know, implications of new technologies? Because I assume your students, like the ones I'm dealing with, and like my children, and like yours,
yeah,
are completely immersed in this technology.
Absolutely. And, well, you know, like you, I teach political economy of communication. So, you know, even that itself is an eye-opener for a lot of students to look at the relationship of economics to state policy, regulation, and how that shapes the kind of culture we get. You add to that the issues of the environment and, you know, put these technologies into an ecological context, and they begin to look at them differently. It's not like they're not fully unaware that these things are going on, but, you know, they're hot topic issues like, do cell phones cause brain cancer? You can discuss that kind of thing because it sort of hits home really, really fast with them, because, you know, their cell phones are their alarm clocks, are their Twitter feeds, are their news sources, and, you know, all of this is, you know, very important to them. You know, should they hold it against their head? Where should they put it in their pockets? I tell the young men to be careful, you know, and that's sort of the entree to this. But we get into it in these classes where I can talk more about all of the media, from the print to the screens that they're using in these days. So, you know, you'll be happy to hear that they're very keen to learn more. They become very excited about the idea that they might be able to change their consuming habits, that they're already changed their consuming habits. Recycling is a part of sort of these routines of being an environmental citizen that many of us already have. So it's not that big of a leap. It is sort of hard to get them to admit to their, let's say, love for these technologies. And in some ways to detach them from that love. That's one of the hardest struggles we have in the classroom. But by the end, you know, they can write their papers and you know, they get the phone numbers for the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. They get the material to help, you know, do do something on campus to reduce the waste there is, to make sure the electronics get into the recycling bins in the proper way, and to, you know, just get more involved. And I've been very happy with, at least with my students the past few years as I was writing this book.
In the book, Rick Maxwell, you and Toby Miller really chronicle some of the extent of e-waste, of the waste that the production of these iPhones, just computer technology, information technology devices creates in the world. And I think it even for someone who is expecting grim news, knowing what you're getting to when you open up your book, it is still shocking to see just how extraordinarily toxic this area is.
Yeah, one of the things that's hard to conceptualize is the total amount of junk that we're throwing out into the waste stream. You know, we can see it in the house. When we have a cell phone that we don't use, you know, we might take it to the cell phone provider and they might have a recycle program, or you might have a recycle program on your campus. But it's the aggregate that really is astounding, and the breathtaking numbers of these devices that are thrown out on a yearly basis. Not because they're not still functioning, but largely because of the promotion and marketing campaigns of a lot of these companies like Apple, which comes out with an upgrade now every 6 months, and most Americans at least recycle or buy a new phone every 12 months now, even though their contract isn't up. They just want the new mythical upgrade that comes with it. So, you know, the increase in demand has led to at least a milestone this year. It'll be the first time that spending on electronics will reach $1 trillion on a global scale, and that's a 5% increase over last year. And remember, we're in the middle of a recession, so this stuff, it's got some magical power that indeed to attract this kind of consumption, and that leads to all kinds of environmental problems.
Well, I mean, the problems when you get rid of cell phones and computer monitors and printers and all this stuff, I mean, is it just that there's a lot of junk, just like if you had a lot of hamburger wrappers or old shoes? Or is there even something more to it than that?
Well, part of it is the attitude, obviously. You know, the idea that we can just, the fast fashion comes, the fast food comes, and we throw away what we don't want. And, you know, there's a kind of unconsciousness there that we have to deal with. And a lot of that is just promoted by the media industries and the consumerism and the advertising. But it's not the same. Obviously, it's not the same kind of waste because of the contents, not just chemical contents, but precious metals, heavy metals, all kinds of poisons that might harm in the long term the populations that are exposed to them. If they're thrown into landfills or not recycled properly. And 85% to 90% now, they're saying, is of the material that we throw away ends up in places like China, Africa, and Latin America for recycling, and which are really just artisanal modes of recycling. They're not high-tech factories of recycling where a lot of this stuff can be recovered in safe conditions.
So, I mean, theoretically or practically, it would be possible to recycle much of the material if that was a priority?
Yeah, and, you know, some groups are trying to make it a priority by pointing out that annual gold and silver deposits, for example, in new high-tech goods are worth about $21 billion, according to recent estimates. So urban mining now is being discussed because you can get 40 to 50 times more mined ore out of the thrown-away equipment than you can out of the actual mines these days, because mining now is such a wasteful and harmful process. So, you know, that's one way to get the business side of things going. But really, it's also an awareness. You know, we don't need to have disposable phones. We need to have durable phones, and you can design these phones to be much more durable. We used to call things like refrigerators consumer durables for a reason. We buy them and keep them for a long time. And, you know, the same with sofas and things. But we see a trend now where people are swapping out sofas. I mean, it's been called the IKEA-ization of you know, households in the United States, for example.
Yeah, it's a great point, Rick Maxwell. In fact, we had on the show a couple of times Juliet Shore talking about that sort of increased turnover of what would once been durables, furniture, appliances, and you know, how wasteful that is and unnecessary. And you're talking about how that goes on with iPhones and computers and high technology. Now, I think to some people like me from the older generation, the assumption has been that a lot of this is driven by the fact that we're in the midst of this great revolution. So there are actually important technological changes such that if you, you know, you get tremendous advantages getting the newest model that makes the old model sort of look like a horse and buggy, like a clunker, like you're using a telegraph or something. And it, at some point you would get to the place where you could just buy a phone or some digital device and you could hold on to it, you know, like you do your car for 10 years or whatever. But you're saying that that's probably not going to ever, we're never going into that day naturally.
Well, it's happening. I mean, there are attempts to, you know, to look into green design for phones. And, you know, there's an area of research called life cycle assessment where the researchers, you know, they're sort of ecological industrialists looking at design substitutions in the chemical composition and other parts. But, you know, this goes back, especially with electronics, this goes back to the 1930s when, you know, companies were told that they had to redesign things to become obsolescent very quickly so that the turnover rate could be increased. You know, this was a conscious way of planning obsolescence. The phrase planned obsolescence should be well known to your listeners. And, you know, this is part of the design mode for these machines. They don't have to do it that way, but it's sort of part of the business strategy. You know, don't make them last. Make that, and then mystify the upgrade, what they're going to get. So, you know, it's not the same as a sofa or a refrigerator, obviously, for a number of reasons, but that business strategy is part of the problem.
So, you know, in a free market, theoretically, if Apple or some company, not to pick on Apple, but they're the one that jumps to your mind when you think of all the continually upgraded iPads, iPods, whatever, when they come up with a new model every 6 months or 9 months, what's to prevent another company to come along and say, well, they're just scamming you with this. Well, here's our model that'll last you 5 years, and you can easily just add applications as they're important. You don't have to plunk down hundreds of dollars to get this new model. Why isn't the market responding that way?
Well, I think you know the answer, but I would say part of it has to do with, you know, just this culture of consumerism. The newness of, you know, marketing a different color, the newness of marketing some sort of external cosmetic change still has a strong effect on the way people think about the operation of these things. And some of the most powerful computers are some of the ugliest things you've ever seen. You know, if you go inside of a server farm, a server warehouse, which is basically a super large computer system, you know, it's ugly. There's nothing about the design that's important there. What's important there is the level of service that it provides to companies that need to have these large storage warehouses for their cloud computing, as it's called now.
Our guest, Rick Maxwell, who you've just been listening to, he is the co-author with Toby Miller of the brand new book, Greening the Media, just published by Oxford University Press. This is a live show, so you can call in if you have any questions or comments. The number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I've been away the last couple weeks. I'm back now. We're going to be running live shows for well into the visible future. So I hope you will be listening and join us. We've got some great guests lined up in coming weeks, including next week. Live on there joining us will be Noam Chomsky to talk about the state of the world. So I hope you'll be with us then. Rick Maxwell, there's so much to talk about in this book. There's so much ground you cover that's really interesting. And one of the things that you go into in the book is, you know, we've seen sort of at a certain level, among a lot of celebrities have taken environmental issues to heart and have really worked on it. And, you know, what's your take on the George Clooney's and Pierce Brosnan's, and there's many others, those are two that jump out, who've made environmental issues central to sort of what their self-image?
Well, the positive take is that they're making these issues public, and they're associating their celebrity with a kind of activism that you know, people who are their fans can perhaps adopt for their own lifestyles. And we've seen, you know, shows on television that come up with this actor or that actor showing up and showing us how they're competing with their neighbor to have the best, you know, water recovery drainage system on their roof or something. And that's all well and good. The problem with that is that it distracts attention away from the underlying problems of where these green technologies come from. And the effort in the book, at least in the chapter where we talk about film and screen technologies, is that it doesn't really it does, again, something of the mystification of hardware. Celebrity is great and it's helpful, and I'm not going to, you know, say don't keep doing it. But you know, I'd like to see more discussion about what's inside of these technologies, what's inside of the old film, the old silver screen, what's inside of the new ones, the flat screen TVs, and all the others. And that's probably one of the reasons why we wrote this book, is to try to get that information out there, because there's just so much distraction, there's just so much buzz around all these technologies, and Celebrity plays a big role in that too, selling these things. And so any kind of discord within the Celebrity world, and you know, they're followed by something called the Ecorazzi now, the paparazzi on the eco beat, which is very interesting, and they have websites where they catch these green celebrities, you know, in the act of driving Priuses and things like that. So it's a lot of fun as far as, you know, greening the media goes, but it's just the surface issues.
Rick Maxwell, how much do you think individuals, by changing their behavior, you know, just taking a burden upon themselves to be more green conscious in their purchases of technologies and how they dispose of them, if they do dispose of them or recycle them, how much would that in and of itself sort of solve the problem? How much is in our hands? It's just we have to wake up and just change our personal consumption patterns.
Well, first, let me say it's good news that, you know, there are a growing number of American consumers and consumers around the world who are reevaluating these technologies. They see the headline news about Apple, exploiting workers in China, and they say, well, what's going on here? This was, the guru, you know, the yoga company, the calm company, the left coast company. No, all of this stuff is kind of opening up a crack in the facade. Recycling old electronics is becoming another routine. We see this, you know, where there are state and municipal laws, the people are, you know, into it, and they do shuffle their stuff off to the recycling center or the container. So there's already a kind of environmental citizenship at work that is very promising and very positive. And, you know, we see this a lot in schools. A lot of K-12 curricula now have an environmental component to it. So, in a sense, what we're seeing is the establishment institutionally of places where people can be part-time environmental citizens and learn some of those routines that could add to what we're calling a larger culture of sustainability. But the problem is works on such a big scale that, you know, we don't want to put all the responsibility on the consumer's shoulders. And in this book, we move from a discussion of consumers and what they can do through several different layers of analysis and history to get to citizens and to talk about green citizenship and the kind of policies that one could imagine that don't exist and the kind of policies that do exist that allow us to operate at a much more activist level of green citizenship. So, you know, I want to say it's positive that people are getting into it. It's just won't be enough on the scale that we need it to operate on. That's why the activists I've mentioned, and there are so many others, Good Electronics, organization, Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior, the Centro de Reflexión y Acción Laboral, which has done a lot of work on maquiladoras, and the Electronics Take Back Coalition, are all working at a level which is much more sustaining an ongoing advocacy and interest beyond the workplace, changes that are taking place.
You've just been listening to Rick Maxwell, co-author with Toby Miller of Greening the Media, just published by Oxford University Press. And Toby was going to join us. He's in Mexico now, and unfortunately, we can't get a good line through to him in Mexico. But he is listening, and he's emailing in comments periodically. And he just responded to the question about celebrities. I got an email from Toby saying that celebrities have causes chosen for them cynically by their agents as self-branding. So I think, introducing a certain amount of skepticism toward celebrities who have this great love of social causes or the environment. One of the things in your book, Rick Maxwell, that I think was really interesting, you go into sort of corporations sort of becoming green corporations, and I suspect there's a sense that, like with celebrities, there's a certain cynicism involved in this. But the most interesting discussion in the book by far was, to me, on this issue, dealt with Rupert Murdoch, who 4 or 5 years ago out of the blue, suddenly became deathly concerned with the fate of the global environment and instituted all sorts of fairly what seemed on the surface to be stringent policies for the entire News Corporation collection of firms, this $30 billion a year empire. I'll talk a little bit about that and then explain to me what has happened in the subsequent years.
Well, News Corp, along with all the other media firms and electronics firms, now have some sort of environmental business strategy. And I put those words together even though they're contradictory for a reason. A lot of this corporate social responsibility activities, this idea that, you can bring in some of these issues. They know their consumers, they know their viewers are interested in. There's a sense that, and as Toby pointed out, a kind of branding, a sort of green-tinted branding of your product will add some a sense that you're doing right for the world, good corporate citizenship. And that's an old, now it's green, but it used to be in the old days of self-regulation in the television business, for example, a way of staving off government regulation. And so, we do look at it cynically. Rupert Murdoch's Fox News is one of the biggest climate change deniers. They say science is a hoax. So on the one hand, you have the voices of Fox News reaching the target audiences that they've managed to habituate to this kinds of crackpot things. And then on the other hand, he's telling people who run his offices, to change the light bulbs, to reduce the paper content, and reduce their overall carbon footprint. Some people say that he's sincere, partly because he's seen what's happened to Australia, and partly because he sees a business strategy at work there. To get ahead of the curve, it's going to happen. We see a lot of companies, big companies like Walmart, deciding that they're going to create a sustainability index. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're multinational corporations affected by regulations, not in the U.S., obviously, but regulations in the European Union that are coming down the pike, and they see that this is a good business. So on the one hand, it's to project to the consumer, to the critics of corporate the corporate malfeasance case of this guy, Rupert Murdoch, but also in a way to really get ahead of the game and try to fend off any kind of regulation.
So Murdoch is... The News Corporation is still implementing these policies from 5 years ago.
Yeah, News Corporation, Disney, Time Warner, they all have a project. They all have an effort to, at the studios to use recyclable bamboo plates and, use LED lighting to change signage to recycle the sets. Internally they have to recycle the sets, an interesting side issue was that I asked somebody at a studio here about that. I said, wouldn't it be possible for independent filmmakers to come and use these sets? And he said, well, no, we have a copyright issue. We can't let them have, the backgrounds that we used on Boardwalk Empire or whatever it was, because we own it. We own the image. So there's a limit to how much they can actually reuse and recycle. So, but there's an effort, everywhere. Sony's big on this, sort of internal reuse policies to try to eliminate the amount of waste and lumber and copper and everything else.
Well, all these other companies are interesting, but I think Murdoch and News Corporation stick out to some extent, not because Murdoch made such a large public pronouncement 5 years ago about his conversion to being greatly concerned about climate change and global warming, but also because, the data shows that in the United States in particular, but also in Britain to a similar extent, the amount of public concern with climate change has plummeted over the last decade, and the percentage of Americans who now believe that there is credible scientific debate over climate change and human role in it has increased sharply. And the only explanation that anyone come up with is that the way the press coverage has treated the issue and taken seriously these sort of frankly bogus arguments.
Well, yeah, and you cover that really well in your book. It's the he said, she said kind of journalism. When the climate science is now, there's scientific consensus, there's no other side. But U.S. journalism always has to go find the other side, and now it's just the leftover crackpot. So that's why you have a lot of U.S. consumers left with, that tagline, well, we'll have to leave it there, ladies and gentlemen, and, decide for yourselves, when there is already clear evidence in the scientific world, at least. I think Murdoch stands out partly because of his Darth Vader image in all of this, and it was a surprising speech when he gave it in 2007. He basically told everybody, go to your teleconference rooms at a given hour, and he talked to the entire company. Everybody had to hear this speech, and the idea was to bring their carbon footprint down to zero by 2010, which is, of course, a goal they never met. But it was clear that he must have had that talk with Al Gore,
But the reason it's striking, though, and I don't want to dwell too much on the point of Rupert Murdoch and the environment, but it bears emphasis that, we're in a situation today where, put 10 years ago or 12 years ago, there wasn't a great deal of debate, even among Republicans, that this was a serious issue. It was understood that climate change threatened the survival of our species on this planet, if not all life, certainly our species, and threatened the quality of life, even if we did survive. And now, 10 years later, Fox News Channel has led the drive to basically make almost virtually uniform opinion of the Republican Party that climate change is a hoax. So he's an active agent in sort of undermining public understanding and involvement on this issue. At the same time, he's lecturing people this is a serious issue.
But I'm not, I'm not surprised that he's operating in a contradictory way. not at all. He came out against Scientology last week. Big surprise.
So I missed that story.
It was a tweet.
Okay, I'm not signed up for his tweets yet. I guess I'll get to that later.
You could follow Rupert maybe and get your daily up.
Yeah, I've got enough Rupert in my life, I think. Our guest today, Rick Maxwell, the co-author with Toby Miller of the new book, Greening the Media, just published, literally out just a month or two back, with Oxford University Press. It's, I'm sure, available if you look for it wherever you buy your books. Toby Miller was supposed to join us. He's in Mexico. Unfortunately, we couldn't get a secure, stable phone line. Toby's listening over the internet and periodically emailing in with comments as he can. And a few minutes ago, he sent me an email when talking about, when we were talking about what role citizens can play. He wanted to emphasize that the crucial factor is going to be regulation and policies nationally and internationally to deal with the green crisis brought on by these technologies. It can't be solved exclusively or even primarily by businesses or individuals being better participants. If people would like to call in, the phone lines are open at 333-9455. The toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to ask you a broader question that occurred to me as I read the book, Rick Maxwell. Naomi Klein, and this follows up really in the Rupert Murdoch material we were just talking about. Naomi Klein wrote an article in The Nation earlier this year, I think it was, beginning of 2012, maybe at the end of last year. And her argument, in effect, was she went to a number of pro-business groups that were anti-environment. They were strongly anti-environmental, and they thought climate change was a hoax and all that. And basically their argument was that if you did the stuff that was necessary to prevent climate change and destruction to the ecology, it would be impossible to have capitalism as we know it. So your choice is either capitalism or a healthy environment. So therefore, they wanted capitalism first, so the environmental thing had to be dismissed as a joke. And, as I read your book, I was wondering, is capitalism as we know it compatible with a healthy environment? It seems like a logical question.
Yeah, it seems like one that you know the answer to. But I'd also say, and this is important to understand, that the ideological stuff you hear from a lot of these places really doesn't match a lot of the internal changes that are taking place. And that, I have to say, even though it might be cynical on their part, it opens up and makes them vulnerable to the kind of research we need to do on what's going on inside these companies. But there's no doubt about, like, the Koch brothers. They would like the entire country to be covered with oil rigs, and then they'd live, I don't know where they'd live, on the moon maybe. But the point is that there is an attempt now, and we've seen this in the last Rio summit, an attempt to try to merge these discourses of economic growth, that is capitalism in terms of the bottom line, economic growth and a green economy. And green economy is sort of supplanted the word sustainability now in a lot of discussions at the high levels of in these UN meetings where all of the big leading countries and influential business people who attempt to try to do something about the climate issues are more or less moving the discourse toward this contradictory notion of sustainable capitalism. So it is incompatible. There are lots of contradictions, but you can also see capitalism with a small c, entrepreneurs who are interested in making this work. Capitalism with a big C and certain big players in a monopolistic framework, you can see making these changes as well, because there are big governments. The European Union's directives to reduce the number of the toxic elements in the equipment that we're talking about in this case, European Union rules about transfer of hazardous waste. There's big opposition and big powerful influences on these multinational corporations too. So they may talk a good game, and they also are really well funded, and people like the Koch brothers are going around and spreading all of this crackpot stuff about the environment and climate change. But it doesn't really have the kind of influence in these higher circles yet that they at least claim it does. But it's a winning argument. Ronald Reagan was very popular with the anti-environmentalist side of the Republican Party because he just took down those solar panels that Carter put on the White House because it was just wasn't right. There's no problem. They don't need alternative energy. That became a symbol of the kind of thing the Republican Party was going to be up to since Reagan, at least. So on the one hand, yes, that's the way they think. On the other hand, they can only think that so far if they want to survive in what's happening around the world with a lot of these corporations who have picked up these green business strategies, as we said, for cosmetic reasons, but also it's leading to a lot of information coming out about what's going on inside. Give the example of Apple again. We wouldn't know if Apple didn't start providing the supplier responsibility reports after pressure from consumers to, go into those factories, find out what they're doing, and now we can read these things. They're not great reports, but we see more and more information. And this goes to a point I wanted to make sure I made before we got off the air. When we're talking about the global supply chain, we don't know a third of what's going on, maybe even less than that, because there's no transparency. This is one of the most opaque systems of in the division of labor of creating these goods that we're talking about here. And it leaves lots of rooms for lots of scoundrels to do lots of bad stuff to the workers down the line. It has the lowest union density just about any sector around the world, and I'm talking information and communication technologies. Low unionization means low alternative institutional support for gathering information, for doing research on working conditions. So the question really is not so much about whether this right-wing idea of what's going on is going to carry the day. The question is, so far as we've seen, any movement we can to open it up is going to be good for us because we'll be able to learn more about what's going on behind the scenes. And again, the Apple example is a very good one because it's causing change. It's causing organization, advocacy, and greater awareness.
Our guest, Rick Maxwell. Let's go to the phone lines now to a caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, this isn't too much of a tangent, I was told. So, but I wanted to wonder. I'm wondering if this Murdoch, what his product overseas is like. Does Sky TV have the same kind of know nothing attitude that Fox does here about climate change?
I don't know anything.
I'd be interested to know. I didn't expect you to know off the top of your head, but I think he's basically giving pandering to the right here, basically, and couldn't do anything else. But what I wanted to get at, when I was first hearing the topic, I didn't know it was more fixed on the production and what you were just referring to. And capitalism has to be proprietary, so they have to be non-transparent, I guess they would argue. But what I'm concerned about is PBS. The Koch brothers notoriously underwrite Nova to was $13 million a while back. I don't know over what period of time. We know about what they're doing with Alec and all the other super PACs, but I had this instance at least several years ago where they did screen something on climate change, and it wasn't bad. But I watched a BBC documentary on the web the same week, and it brought up ocean acidification, which is one of the most scary things about carbon dioxide problem we have, is because we could kill the oceans, at least transform them incredibly, as you were referring to earlier. And it was not mentioned on this NOVA program. So I just wanted to raise that as an insight. I don't know how you'll react, but it seems to me that it's another example of political economy of media and who's who's paying the piper.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, you probably answer this one too, but I think, yeah, it makes me worry more about the American audience than it does about the British audience, for example, where, you know, I think there's an assumption that the audience there is going to understand all these, you know, expert opinions and scientific ideas and theories, and a lot of that has to do with the failure of American K-12 education to provide that kind of comfort level with you know, theoretical knowledge, conceptual knowledge that has to do with how science operates. So when you start talking about specific processes of, let's say, acidification, you know, which may be caused by the dumping of certain chemicals or the particulate matter in greenhouse gases that are interacting, and chemical interactions on the Earth are constant, ongoing, you know, it becomes very abstract. And, you know, recently, maybe this is a good analogy, one of the reporting on the financial scandals going on right now are really not very smart in the U.S., but if you go around and, you know, the channels, look at BBC or Al Jazeera or some of these other sites where you can see the assumption that the audience is going to understand more of this, then you get the details. It's just that Americans are, you know, I hate to say it, but they, you know, they're not getting the kind of background training to be able to think about these issues in a way that would allow them to, allow the producers to say, oh, they'll be able to get it. Producers are probably making a decision right now, you know, nobody's going to get this. And that's why a lot of our financial reporting sucks and why a lot of our environmental reporting sucks. And by the way, there's a lot of good environmental journalism out there. Just most of it's in print form.
Our guest, Rick Maxwell, co-author with Toby Miller of the new book, Greening the Media, just published by Oxford University Press. And for a bit of clarification for listeners who might not, would have no reason to know this, when we talked, the caller talks about Sky TV, that is Rupert Murdoch's satellite/cable TV channel in England, his English or British equivalent of Fox News, although it operates in somewhat different style than Fox News does domestically in the United States. Rick Maxwell, let's say President Obama picked up a copy of this book, Greening the Media, and read it and said to an aide, boy, this Maxwell, Miller, these are two smart dudes. I want to talk to them and get their feedback. And President Obama said, send me a one-pager, Rick Maxwell, with three policy recommendations that would help address this problem going forward that I could, you know, implement as president. What sort of things would you put on that list?
President Obama is going to pick up my book. First thing I'm going to tell him, skip the intro, go right to the first chapter on consumers, since we get a little bit academic in the intro. The other thing is, you know, you make it really hard for me because this is complex stuff, you know, and federal efforts to regulate these matters has been difficult, next to nothing, except in the period when there were what are called absolute prescriptions. When we had the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, they were just, you know, very clear cut. There was no kind of dilly dallying about the science on it. Today we have a longer conversation about risk management and choose populations we'd like to expose to unhealthy water, unhealthy air, and those we'd like to save as a matter of cost and benefit analysis. It'd take a while, but I guess the first thing I'd say is adopt the European Union standards for hazardous waste management. Adopt them on a federal level and make it impossible for that crap to come across the country and go in and out of this country, and any dealings you have with any other, with any kind of international trade would abide by those standards, and they're very good standards, and they're hard to implement, and that's been the biggest problem in the European Union. But I'd say, you know, try to come up with a way to synchronize with the best practices, and those are some of the ones we point to.
Are there any politicians in America today who are making that position or advocating that we adopt those sort of standards?
Yeah, on the local scale, even in New York City, we passed recently a recycling law, which is applying something called extended producer responsibility. The EPR, I think you might be familiar with. It's not widely practiced in the U.S., but it's a policy whereby the manufacturer basically takes responsibility for the product throughout its whole life, including the end of management, what's called the end of life management of the product. So in the end of the, you know, when your iPhone is at the end of its life, or your television that is at the end of its life, and you're planning to trade it in, the manufacturer has to pay for its pickup and recycling or reuse or refurbishment. That's a part of a new law in New York City. It's kind of fractured, but in spirit, it picks up on the extended producer responsibility. It has problems. It doesn't include any kind of pickup policy. So the little old ladies who live in the co-ops here, may be fine for putting their TV, having the super put the TV on the sidewalk, which may change their behavior, but it still doesn't provide that kind of instrument for delivering these goods to the manufacturer. So, the parts of the law are missing. You see that on local scale all over the place. On a state-based scale or regional scale, you have great great laws in Massachusetts. So I was just at a dump the other day where you have great separation of these electronic these goods. The trick is always implementation. Following the trail of the recyclers, making sure that they're reputable recyclers, that they're not being sent into the global waste business, which operates in a very sort of black market way. It's a lot cheaper, especially for the scoundrels who run these places. It's a lot cheaper just to throw the stuff to the side of the road, so to speak, and rather than to find a reputable recycler. But there are patchwork laws across the country, and it depends where you live. California has laws where they'll fine you if you put something out on the sidewalk, and this is all coming in slowly, bit by bit, but you can see it. It's just not happening on a federal level. There's no omnibus law that, except for the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. And then we have the rights, the states fighting the implementation of EPA rules, and you can see that battle across the country in a number of different areas. So the EPA has been its powers have been diminished under certain presidents, and it's trying to beef up its powers now. We'll see how long that lasts.
What sort of performance do you think the Obama administration has provided on environmental issues, especially pertaining to information and communication technologies?
Well, there was a short-lived attempt to have this green economy and green shoots and all that business. But you remember Van Jones, I'm sure, who was attacked. I forget what his position was in the Obama administration. Maybe you can
I think remember. Green Jobs Advisor.
Green Jobs Advisor, and he was vilified and demonized as some sort of socialist devil by people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and left. So the problem is not that there wasn't a it kind of fit the style and it fit the model, but he didn't have a way to make it happen and given the climate of attacks that he was under. So you can see there are openings within the Obama administration, and you can see some efforts on the part of the EPA to, get back into the game. And a lot of that, from my point of view, is not just implementation, but also getting the research out there. There are so many new components that go into these electronics that aren't reviewed by the EPA, and the risk factors. We all know the risk factors of lead, the risk factors of mercury. Very clear now. But new chemicals are being processed, new components are being put together with these chemicals. And a lot of toxicologists are saying, it takes them their lifetime to figure out what the effect of these things would be. So there's, there's kind of like a race that the EPA is losing in terms of science and research and development moving way too fast for the regulators to keep up with what the stuff does and what the risk factors are. And then, of course, the industry does its own studies and says, well, we've done our studies. There's no need to worry. And, the best example of that is the cell phone radiation question, which, is sort of up in the air still. In the U.S., at least, the FCC says not to worry.
Well, is there a credible reason that other people say you should worry about cell phone radiation?
Well, the research is ongoing. It hasn't been that long that the people have had cell phones stuck to their heads, walking around with their lattes, 24/7. So the long-term research is just not coming in. And there's research that says, yes, there's some indication, and there's research that says, no, there's no clear evidence. But the point is that some of the research is saying there's a connection, and it depends how your political culture responds to this. And you take a case like France, for example. Operates on what's called the precautionary principle. So, the French Senate has decided that, there's enough evidence to make us worry. So let's have a precautionary principle, better safe than sorry principle applied to a law. Let's not let kids use phones. Let's not let advertisers advertise to kids under some, arbitrary age, like 12 or something. Let's be cautious. And you can see this in other European nations, Israel, Switzerland, and other places around the world, where a precautionary principle based on the science that's available is taking sort of the thinking and pushing into law some of these practices and guidelines. Some of them aren't just warnings. Some of them are about, you know, providing maps so people can avoid transmission towers. You know, we have laws that make sure that a transmission tower can't be erected near a school. We already have that here, so, you know, we know that something's up. And, you know, there have to be environmental impact statements whenever a new cell tower goes up, not just because of the magnetic field, but also because of the, you know, the effect on migratory birds. There's a large bird kill population every year whenever we stick these towers up, especially in the paths of migratory birds. So, you know, all kinds of reasons why a precautionary principle is much better than waiting for all the science to be in before you make a decision. And, you know, I urge people to read the reports. There are great reports by the Environmental Working Group that bring together all of the cell phone studies and try to summarize and present them as clear and objective a way as possible, but also a list of the countries that are making moves based on what's out there.
Rick, I want to ask you another time, probably a question I've already asked earlier, but I'll rephrase it slightly because it's one I'm hit with constantly. So I'm very interested, and I suspect you've heard it too, especially from students. And that is, you know, you study the political economy of communication, you study how the policies are made, you look at the dangerous effects. And so you're discussing a situation where cell phone companies, AT&T and Verizon, two of the 15 largest companies in the world, let's face it, they floss their teeth with the underwear of politicians. Right. You know, they own these guys.
I love that line of yours.
Yeah, and they just dominate Washington and state capitals. And then you're talking about a company like Apple, the largest company in the world. And, you know, they basically get their way. And you have the Koch brothers now with their oil concerns. And, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy elections. So the idea of these guys losing any sort of political fight, at least in the United States, seems to be getting further and further from shore, not closer, given the way the system is stacked. And what do you say to students who presented with that information, say, it's hopeless?
I say it seems that way once you begin to realize that these political powers and the power structure that that we're going to talk about in this class, for example, and you're going to learn more about it. I mean, the first week or two, they all hit that wall of despair. And it's, you know, something, you know, as a political economist, and, you know, you're trying to teach, students to think as a political economist, you know, you have to deal with that. And I see it all the time, and I know why you're asking this question. The scale of the problem seems to be overwhelming. The failure of our political culture to do anything about it makes everybody feel helpless. And you've written about this as well, and a lot of it has to do with the failure of our media and the crisis of journalism, the failure of business journalism, for example, to do their jobs, and now the failure of journalism to actually report what's going on in terms of the climate change. That there's good evidence that a lot of the fires and the droughts that we're experiencing now across the country, this is just symptomatic of the climate change, but the press is not covering it. So, you know, there's a way to empower people with information, as you know. There's a way for people to think, oh, this is manageable if we can hear more of the resources that are available to us, and the critical voices that are out there. So we see we're not alone, and in fact we're not alone. We've seen a rising number of people who self-identify as environmentalists or as pro-environment, are thinking more about political action along these lines. On a global scale, in the U.S., there's been a growth in that area too, in terms of awareness. So my guess is that, you know, when you present the big picture, the first impression you give them is that it's hopeless. It's one of despair. But when you present the bigger picture, the role of policy, the role of governments, which still are very, very powerful, and how and where you've seen examples of where change can take place, and a lot of that is international, especially if you're teaching a class in the United States, you can provide a number of different examples from around the world.
Rick Maxwell, on that note, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Rick Maxwell, the co-author with Toby Miller of the new book, Greening the Media, our guest today on Media Matters. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for being my engineer, Christina Williams for being my producer. I'm Bob McChesney, back in 167 hours, the live hour with Noam Chomsky. I think you'll have a great time then. Until then, have a good week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
There's a break from the extreme heat in the forecast. Partly sunny today, a slight chance of showers, not as warm, the high 88 degrees. Winds up to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy tonight, the low around 65 degrees, winds up to 15 miles an hour. Mostly sunny tomorrow, the high 85. Mostly clear tomorrow night, the low 65 degrees. Tuesday through Friday, partly cloudy, the high 88, the low 68.